when you can buy in-game items and sort of make your character stronger or get advantages. Now, I'll confess, when I play some games, I'll sometimes buy it because it is more fun if suddenly your character has a lot more great stuff that would take you 6 months or a year to build up. So sometimes I'll spend $20 and buy a treasure chest full of coins because then I can spend them to get cool things in the game.
Yes, folks. Two guys who have to work for all your boxes.
Yes. I work for my my player points here.
Welcome, folks. Left to Reckoning 72 UK Railway Strike, Free Assange, and folks, we have an important story to get to. We have this massive strike in the UK, that may reverberate for a while. We have the emergence of a charismatic labor leader right before our eyes. And we got time for all that stuff. What's important to get to up front is Ted Cruz is talking about microtransactions. We have some gaming news. And look, David brought this clip to my attention where Ted Cruz is talking about loot boxes. And I needed the full context. I needed to hear how he qualified it, where he came down on it. And I think actually playing the full question is valuable because we hear a lot about, you know, kids being victims of stuff. Well, this comes from a Ted Cruz listener who is concerned about basically the addictive nature of gaming combined with the financial exploitation of children. Here is Ted Cruz's response to that.
There was a mailbag question that came in. I mentioned it to you a little bit earlier because I didn't know anything about it. But
I should say this is Ted Cruz's own podcast that he does with Michael Knowles, a failed actor turned Daily Wire sort of hack, which astounds me that I guess he has time for this. I mean, in between like Cancun trips and stuff like this, he's doing a crappy a show where he's just doing what we do, basically.
Would love your take on it. If you have formed one. This is from Chris. I believe Chris is – or I'm sorry. The question is from Jonathan, but it's about someone who is one of your constituents. Question is, the Twitch streamer Asmon Gold said he reached out to Senator Cruz's office about regulating loot boxes in video games. Where does the senator stand on loot boxes? I know that those are all words, and I understand they have been strung together in an English sentence, but I don't really understand what it means semantically together.
Look, I'm happy to engage in a conversation with him. I'm happy to see what he has to say on it. As I understand it, the concern he's raising is a concern about gambling and kids. And I will say it is certainly true that social media, online environments, including video games, are designed to be addictive. Now, I'm something of a gamer. I'm not a gamer like hardcore Twitch streamers, and I don't do the massive multiplayer games.
Not yet, Senator, but I'll tell you, I bet you never thought that you were going to be a top podcaster. So who knows? We may have to.
This is just Michael Knowles coming in with some comic relief here. I mean, good lord, that's like a hard cut to Michael Knowles with just the lamest joke ever.
Launch the Verdict Twitch stream and start playing Pac-Man or whatever the kids are playing these days.
That could well be. And you remember when you and I did Dave Rubin's podcast, nice. We did a Twitch stream on playing, I think it was Nintendo that he had, and we did that. And if I remember right, I beat his ass. I'm pretty sure that's right. And if not,
sorry, I just gonna skip ahead.
Look, they're different components of it. In games, I'll tell you, I don't like it when you can buy in-game.
So listen to how he started that. I don't like it how you can buy. Well, let's see how much he doesn't like that.
Now, I'll confess, when I play some games, I'll sometimes buy it because it is more fun if suddenly your character has a lot more great stuff that would take you 6 months or a year to build up. So sometimes I'll spend $20 and buy a treasure chest full of coins because then I can spend them to get cool things in the game. You know, I think it is a greater concern when you're dealing with kids. when you're dealing with minors who have a potential, number one, to spend a whole lot of money?
Do kids play video games?
I don't know.
And, you know, with some of the loot boxes, there's a fair amount of randomness that you could get a lot of great stuff or some lousy stuff. And so I guess that's the argument that it's gambling. I'll confess I haven't. I'm open to hearing arguments on this, but I approach the issue with a pretty strong libertarian bent. So I'd like to not see kids exploited and harmed. And so,
but that is a contradiction with my libertarian values.
Exactly. But, you know, there's a profit to be made. And let me just say, like, I'm actually not entirely different than Ted Cruz. I've put credits into my team, and it is absolutely gambling. And it makes me feel the exact same way I felt doing slot machines in Manoman, Minnesota. Like, it, as I was gonna say, like, not great. And like it is 100% gambling. It's buying. I mean, I guess you could make that argument about trading cards in general. And I'll say I also spent an awful lot of money on trading cards, basketball cards, particularly as a kid. And I don't know what the right governmental solution is, other than like, I mean, one. I think the first thing to say is that this is what happens with like. Inequality in capitalism is that like they're not going to leave that money on the table unless you force them not to,
or Monopoly too, right? Like you know, like that's thinking about games like 2K, right? Like there is not a basketball game that has the licensing like NBA 2K does. And you know, this might, you know, not be the most interesting thing to some folks, but like it is worth noting that like what they've basically done is they've made the game extremely hard to play. They lower the quality of your players. Like, you know, if you play that game and you like have like a personally created character, like you start out in the NBA and you can't even dunk a basketball, right? Like, and they do that so that you either have to grind out for hours upon hours or give them like $10 just so you can get your player like decent enough to be able to compete, right? And like that's a super, super nasty thing to be doing on top of a game that's already regulated so that the price is $60 up front. To then be making you pay $10, $15 just to actually be able to effectively play the damn game.
Yeah, the My Career mode is like, that's the one mode I don't play because it's like, your guy just sucks unless you like give him $19.99 for a series of tokens that you can say like, okay, now I have a serviceable jump shot at least. It's really wild how, you know, like I remember the theorizing of this like 10 years ago, like how are these microtransactions going to change video games. And it means that they're very lucrative for a very similar product year in, year out.
Totally. Well, we got a fun episode coming up for everybody. We're going to be joined in just a little bit by Chip Gibbons to talk about Julian Assange and the Biden administration's war on journalists and journalism. But before we get there, we have a pretty exciting story, a hopeful story to start with. Which is now the largest strike in decades in the United Kingdom, where 40,000 members of the RMT have been going on strike all throughout this week. It will continue throughout the week. And it's been an interesting political moment. You know, just to give people the bare bones, in case you haven't seen it or followed it, the union voted to take industrial action because with rampant inflation they're effectively facing a pay cut here because their wage is worth less than it was a couple of years ago. And they have asked for a solution for their workers for the escalating costs of living. And remember, this just goes back to all of like the basic like first principles of like socialism and Marxism. Why are workers like the agent of radical egalitarian change? And it's because they hold a very, very important role in production and in the functioning of society. And in the United Kingdom, the railway system is crucial. And shutting this down has effectively shut down large parts of the country. People who are trying to travel now, you know, are facing hours, you know, transit times for things that used to just take them maybe, you know, 20, 30 minutes, right? So this has been an extremely effective action. There's been a lot of pushback from the Tory government. There's been a lot of pushback from, ironically, the Labour Party, and we'll get to all that in just a moment. But I just want people to recognize just how historic this action has been, how upright the workers engaging in this fight have been, and also how wonderful the general public solidarity has been, even for something that immediately is inconveniencing people. People are recognizing that this is a fight, and out of a fight that is important, a fight that affects them too, because better standards of living for their fellow workers also can translate to better standards of living for all of us. And like, it's just been a really, really fascinating, fascinating story here. Not the least, the rise of Mick Lynch, who is one of the leaders of the RMT, who has just been performing a masterclass, frankly, for how to be a pro-labor, pro-worker figure in a very, very hostile, right-wing oriented media sphere.
Yeah, it's been, and we'll play a clip, a few clips here, but I just want to say, like, I've been doing this sort of job for a while, and rarely when someone rockets to your attention like this, is it for something that's good. Yeah. Right? It's like, oh, here's fucking Jordan Peterson. I guess we got to deal with this guy for the next half decade. This sort of, the way Mick Lynch is just cutting through so much bullshit and able to, like, speak just directly to all the vilest sort of, I mean, the UK press is a problem. it's just nasty, a nasty, nasty place, even compared to ours, my experience, honestly. But let's play some of these clips here. Here's clip number one. We'll do a little highlights session.
This first clip is him engaging with a Tory backbencher.
That 3% is a very good offer on the table with modernisation. But you've heard, even now, Network Rail are moving to a position where they're saying we will go above 3% with modernisation. And Mick's talking about, you know, modernisation is a scary thing. Modernisation, such as installing an app on your phone so you can communicate better with your workers, or having sensors on trains to detect deficiencies in the rail network. I don't think are controversial things. I think they're good things because they means that drivers are safer, and ultimately, or people on the rail line as well are safer. And that's what we want to see, the best health and safety we can. And what Mick's doing is undermining the rail network. We know passenger numbers are down by about 20% to pre-pandemic levels. We are in a world where we want to get to a place where we have net zero. That means encouraging more people onto public transport. These strikes are only going to drive people further away from it. And the pay rise that Mick wants will therefore just add more cost to the rail network, making it more unaffordable for more working people. He should be apologising to the doctors and nurses who can't get to hospital, the patients who can't get their operation, the kids who will miss out on their education today, but also those armed forces veterans who risk their lives for our freedoms, who won't be able to celebrate Armed Forces Day on Saturday.
Do you want to apologise for all that, Mick?
Well, I think Jonathan should apologise for talking nonsense. None of that is true. We have got automated technology on trains. We've got pantograph cameras. We've got ultrasonic sensors. We've got things that detect faults on tracks. That is all rubbish. I negotiated that deal with Network Rail myself. We've got on-train technicians, all sorts of new technology that is being deployed. So that is just stuff that's written in Conservative Central Office for backbench MPs to spout.
No, sorry,
with their
to
ministers.
Veterans, Mick. Okay, so no
now,
sorry to
I
veterans.
I don't want this disruption. I don't want people to be inconvenienced, and I want a settlement to this dispute. I can't do that with a backbench MP who's just learned it off a script.
Well, hang on. Let
we
him
know
respond.
What the,
well, let
we
him
know
respond
what the
to
issues
that.
Are.
Let me respond.
I mean, just absolutely perfect, refusing to accept any of the premise. And I just wanted to note here, because it's going to be a little bit of a theme in some of these clips and also some of the quotes that we're going to read out, that it's really vile the way that the Tories and the opponents of the union here are trying to use these kind of socially progressive talking points, right? As if, like, the RMT, for example, the union here, is the force that is standing up against decarbonization. They want to get people back on the trains. They just want to make sure that they're getting paid fairly for that kind of work. They want to make sure that veterans can go and celebrate on Saturday. It's the Tory government and these companies that's preventing that from happening by refusing to accept an extremely reasonable deal for a pay increase to make sure that these people can continue to live in the communities that they serve, as they've seen not only mass inflation, but inflation that has been caused because of corporate pillaging of the economy, right? Like the reason that we're seeing so much inflation right now is not because workers have had it too good. It's because those at the top have been able to trap incredible benefits from both government policy and the way that the economy has been structured for generations to themselves that is creating a massive increase in inflation that is also only spurred on by these corporations and deciding that they're going to increase the prices that they charge consumers, right? Remember when people talk about inflation, what class is to blame? It's not the workers. And it's incredibly disingenuous of this guy to imply the workers there and also to invoke climate change, you know, something that his party has done everything in their capacity to prevent any kind of serious action on.
Yeah, and we really need to flood the zone with sentiment here because you look at what the press is doing. This is the BBC that tweeted our article, passengers set to miss life events due to the rail strike. And at Momrat Emily has a very succinct way of putting it. Labor strikes disrupt life as usual because life as usual is built on the exploitation of workers.
Yes.
Exactly. And it's time to stand up to that. We also have, do you want this Ronin?
Let me just throw this in here just because again, for people who aren't in the United Kingdom, you're probably not seeing all these headlines. And like, yeah, there's like these sob stories where they're like interviewing students, you know, going into their final exam. And it's like, oh, my Lord, it's so difficult for you to take your final exam and also be worried about the trains. You know, this is so terrible that it's happening to you. And certainly these things have effects, right? And people know that. Well, that's why they take industrial action going on strike seriously. Yeah. But the framing is like, look at these greedy workers here who are screwing you over and not the government or the corporations here. And I just wanted to note this clip because I think it's a fun one because I believe this is Sky News and they're trying to get this taxi driver to jump in on it. And he basically refuses. I have it right here.
It's tough times for the taxi drivers. And it's even tougher times now that these rail strikes are going to put a squeeze on your trade.
Yeah. First and foremost, I want to say that the men and women of the train unions, I totally, totally, totally 100% back them. They have a right to stand up for the working rights. And it's unfortunate that we don't have more unions that are strong enough to stand up for that. Mm-hmm. I'm an ex-coal miner myself, so I believe in the union structure. I totally support them. If it has to bite on us, then so be it. You know, we're prepared to do that. You know, we made the strongest stuff around these ports.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks for talking to me.
Just did not go the way that they were hoping that was going to go, did it?
That's civilization. Like, that guy right there represents what I understand civilization to be. If we get everyone to be a fucking citizen like that guy, I mean, just amazing. And yeah, thanks for talking to me. Yeah.
Let's pull up this next bit, too. Also, we got to give like a quick shout out because that guy had an incredible fit too.
Yeah, I did. It's looking good. Is this the liar clip you want to go?
Sure,
to?
Whichever one.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. I mean, we could literally just go for 4 hours tonight with this guy's movie. Oops, sorry.
Halfway through these negotiations, while they were ongoing, the unions came out onto the street and gave an impromptu press conference. I mean, it's TV footage, saying that the strike was going to continue.
Okay, let's just pause.
Lie.
Hang on.
I mean, it's on video.
Mick Lynch, excuse me. Mick Lynch, I want to ask you a question. Would you be prepared to negotiate with the Tory government, yes or no?
Absolutely. I've met every Tory transport minister in the last year. Mm-hmm. Bus, rail, maritime and the Secretary of State. We've never said we won't meet the Tories. What we said was that they're not at the table. I'm negotiating with the employers. You've also lied that we left negotiations on Saturday and went to a rally. There were no negotiations scheduled for Saturday. You are a liar.
Right, let's just hang on.
There's a video of him walking out this afternoon giving a press conference. It's on videotape.
And then we went back to the talks.
Yeah,
you're lying.
Having said the strike's going to go ahead.
You are a liar.
Okay, well, let's just...
just like... I mean, it's extremely powerful stuff and is also, you know, something that's been missing from public discourse for a long time. Just calling out this kind of BS talking point. And Mick, I mean, think has the delivery to just be able to rise above all of that and not get bogged down in it.
And it's so nice to have a guy who's represented workers and not a political party.
Yes,
I feel like
absolutely.
That's part of what feels like amazing about this is like he's looking out for his people. Like it's awesome. Should we keep going? Where do you want to go to next?
Yeah, let's go to this. Well, let's go to this Ronin piece because I just wanted to highlight some of the language that's being used by mm-hmm. the right wing here because it's very important. Ronin good friend of us at TMBS, editor at Tribune Magazine in the United Kingdom, wrote a piece called "Why the Establishment Hates the RMT." And he notes this line right here, which I just think is quite despicable. Throughout this month, media commentators and politicians have sought to frame the strike as a matter of privilege. A train driver is paid on average £59,000, Transport Minister Grant Shapps told Sky News. A nurse is paid £31,000. Given that disparity, how could these greedy RMT workers demand more? Mm-hmm. And let's just look at a couple things here. Unbelievable for a party that represents entrenched aristocratic privilege to sit here and talk about privilege in the first place. Just ridiculous on its face. But also remember, this is exactly the kind of anti-solidarity rhetoric that happens in this country, too. A very famous one that I can think of is when we do things like the Fight for 15, a basic minimum wage that people should be paid. Something that the right wing loves to bring up is we'll look at EMS workers, first responders, people who show up in the ambulance to take care of you in your moments of need. Those people are only paid $14 an hour. So you're saying that that's more important than, you know, making cheeseburgers or whatever, right? And inherently anti-solidarity rhetoric, especially when the answer is simple. No, those people should be getting paid more. And that is the exact point of this fight, is saying the floor is too low and that brings everybody's standards of living down. But the thing is that even in this context, right, that is extremely disingenuous. As Ronan goes on to say, when he said that, Shapps knew that the dispute was not about train drivers, but about 40,000 workers across a vast range of jobs on the railway. He also knew their median salary, £31,000 a year. A clear example of misdirection you would struggle to find, but at least the nurses can look forward to his support when they ballot, when they vote to go on strike, right? The fact is that the union certainly has some membership who were paid, you know, a little bit more than median salaries or whatever in the country. It's more despicable that this government is not paying nurses more, frankly. And also, yeah. the union is representing a wide group who are all paid differently, and their wages actually are very, very low compared to other workers in the country, right? So disingenuous from the Tories. The entire framing of it is anti-solidarity based, even if like the facts were true, which they're not. And it just shows exactly how the right wing and the capitalist press tries to create these tiers in your mind about what worker is more privileged than the other. Because even at the high salary that the Tory member of government was saying was some height of privilege, you can't afford to live in a city like London, which has been completely opened up for privateering billionaires and a group of people who have basically risen all the price of real estate in that area. The pilfering of the public good, when you've seen council houses turn into go from under public control into private control, which has meant that many of those have now become some of the more expensive places to live. Houses that were built with the intention of them being for the people, now being used as vehicles for private gain, right? Like, those are the people who are privileged, not somebody who does the necessary labor to make sure that the society can function. Just absolutely despicable one through and through.
It's wild, honestly, to hear Boris Johnson talk about, we are all in this together and we need pay discipline to come out against this inflation. Like, pay discipline? You start talking like that, like that's when us Americans start throwing tea in the river, like like pay discipline. What? Like, no, there's everything's there, the costs of everything rises. We need more money to pay for that stuff. Take it from like all of the financiers that you've rented the city out to. Like, yes. There's one reason that I could think of to like be so obsequious to like world financial interests, and that's to trap them. And at a certain point, like, seize some of that stuff back for like the people there.
And in the U.S., we have the luxury of people like Larry Summers or Fed Chair Powell coming out quite frankly and saying the way that they want to deal with inflation is to punish and lower the standards of living for workers. But pay attention to where this kind of like we're all in it together rhetoric is. It's always about getting wage cuts for working people. It's never about confiscating and pushing back on the extreme wealth inequality that we have in both the United States and the United Kingdom, which is a much, much larger driver of inflation than anything that any amount of the money that's gone to working people in the first place.
Yeah, it, it's like at a certain point, when through everything that we're told by these by like the political parties that cater to these rich folks, that the world is collapsing. Well, none of you seem to be affected by it really at all. And so you need rail workers to face the to take 18,000 more jobs lost so we can fight inflation. Are you fucking kidding me?
No, it's a joke. We got another one coming.
We got one here. Yep.
This is, I think, out of all the clips, I love all of them. This one is the one of the best because Mick lays out very, very clearly what's happening, not just in the United Kingdom, but also across the world.
Oh, come on. Let me refresh.
Okay, and, no worries. Well, while you're getting that ready, I also wanted to note that this hasn't been isolated, this pushback. So it looks like we don't know how it's going to go yet, but this is from Reuters. UK, let me pull it up for y'all right quick. UK union to ballot postal workers over Royal Mail pay award. The union representing staff at British postal group Royal Mail said on Tuesday it would hold a ballot that could lead to an industrial action after the two sides clashed over pay. Royal Mail, which blamed the Communication Workers Union for threatening its ability to hit profit targets in May, said it had offered a 5.5% pay raise for CWU grade workers, its biggest increase in years. The union rejected the terms, it said. The step towards the postal service strikes comes as Britain's trade unions grapple with employers overpay in the face of surging inflation. Britain's rail network was brought to a near standstill on Tuesday by its biggest strike in 30 years. So the Tory government and the powerful in this country, in that country, now face the potential where not only are the trains coming to a halt, that the mail itself might shut down. And remember that, like, you know, all of this kind of, this is a big trick here that they're doing when they're talking about the deal that the RMT is trying to negotiate and the deal here with the union with the rail mail workers, is they're saying, like, well, look at this pay increase. It's like the largest that we've seen in years. We'll compare that to the actual inflation that people are experiencing. Because if inflation is going up 10% and you get a 5% raise, you are getting a 5% pay cut. That is what you are getting. That's not a pay raise, right? That's a pay cut just misdirected so it doesn't seem like it. And always remember that whenever they try to frame it in that way, that they're trying to obscure that fact. Because that's a very clear, a very easy thing to do. The media loves to talk about inflation, except in the context of people's wages and the amount of money that they're taking home at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I got this clip for us now, too.
If you're saying that everyone deserves a pay rise, are you not worried about the impact that this could have on inflation, which is, you know, the very thing that everyone's really concerned about? You know, the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey calling for pay restraint because it could...
Well, pay restraint, he's on £600,000 a year, as is the Chief of Network Rail. There are railway bosses taking home millions of pounds every year. The railways made £500 million of profit last year when fares and passengers were at an all-time low. People are stripping money out of the railway. They're stripping money out of the economy. And if workers' wages don't go up, it means a transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich. We've got more billionaires than we've ever had in this country. The rich have never been richer. And the reason they're able to do that and get richer all the time is because they're deliberately depressing workers' wages. Inflation has come on board now, and virtually nobody's had a pay rise for the last two or three years. So this idea that there's a wages price spiral is nonsense.
This has been just some of the best mass political education I think we've seen in years. I mean, just laying it out extremely clearly. And I love that point, too, that it's not just about a question of like, oh, is this meeting our standards? When you're able to suppress wages, that means you get more money and profit. And that has to be remembered as a part of this equation here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I saw Grace Blakely actually made a similar point. Like, where's the money going? Yeah. Like, prices are rising. Now, we do have two little entries for the worst responses to the strike here. First comes from a guy named, frankly, too close to my own name. His name is Matthew Lesh.
that is scary.
And I'm Matt Leck, you know. But anyway, strolled straight past the RMT union picket line for my train. A pretty pathetic effort. I'm not going to do the accent. Barely anybody bothered to show up, screams of scabbed out. I just want to say, when I look at that photo, I know who I'm sympathetic to, and it's not the Wallace and Gromit guy in the foreground.
And it also should be noted, this is a guy who works for a free market think tank, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's one of the real tragedies of the moment is that, well, you can imagine the way that our opponents look. They actually all just look like this guy.
I know, man. Also, the Liberal Democrats, a party who I
taking a strong stance on this huge issue here.
I mean, I don't know why these folks exist, but this is amazing. Frankly, this is from the Lib Dems. This was a deleted tweet. Frankly, the government and RMT are just as bad as each other. The country is sick of them both playing with people's lives. That whole "they're just as bad as each other" is the most infantile way of elaborating it. Frankly, the dumbest way to look at anything political. Like, it's everything is just bad, and if everyone could just agree that, you know, politics is bad, we could all like have a, you know, go have our coffee or our lattes or something like that. Like, I hate this.
Well, the point here is with the Liberal Democrats is that they have lived beyond their need. Because the need for them as a party was for a place for whiny people who were scared of being associated with the Tory party, but wanted to oppose any kind of policy that was going to improve people's lives. Remember, you know, this is a group that, you know, broke ranks with the Labor Party back in the day to implement bag taxes on working people and increase the amount of taxes that people had to pay, right? You know, just a really vile organization. And you don't need them anymore because the Labor Party under Keir Starmer has completely turned their back on the people that their party's name implies that they should be representing. Mm-hmm. So Keir Starmer is not supporting the strikes or the union here. He has also forbidden Labor MPs from showing up on the picket line with these workers who are fighting for their basic right to organize and to voice their displeasure at truly a draconian and severe austerity that is trying to be put on them by the Tory party. Keir Starmer not only is not standing with them, he is threatening members of his own party that if they stand with them, he will take disciplinary action. And as you've seen with Jeremy Corbyn and the coup that followed there, you know, they are willing to go quite far in fighting to make sure that the Labor Party is a party that is friendly to capital over the interests of workers. This is the fella here. No, I mean, it's truly, truly despicable. There has been, I mean, I think it's worth noting, there has been dissent from within the party to this rule, where there have been some members who have shown up at the picket line. There's also just some of the things that I've read, like in The Guardian, whispers that if he does try to discipline members, that more people will actually stand up and push back against it. But it's just a really notable thing, especially for people in the United States who might not have been following what's happened post-Corbyn here, to recognize that it has never been more clear that both the party of government, the Tory party, and the party of opposition are united in fighting for the interests of capital over the interests of workers across the board. And this exciting labor action and all of the solidarity and movement that we're seeing is a very, very encouraging sign that people are recognizing that this carcass of the Labor Party under Keir Starmer is no longer going to represent them, and they're going to take matters into their own hands, and they have direct tools that they can use to improve not only their lives, but through the inspiration and the mobilization here, the lives of many, many, many other working people.
Yeah, absolutely. Really well put. I mean, yeah, like, I mean, that this is happening at a time when the Labor Party has just become the Lib Dems it's very interesting.
In some ways, I mean, frankly, even worse, like they don't even have the balls to show up for something like this. It's ridiculous. You know, Tories have accused the RMT of bankrolling the Labor Party, which is not true because the RMT disaffiliated from the Labor Party in 2004. And as we're seeing, many other unions in the country have have either disaffiliated or have active campaigns to disaffiliate from the Labour Party, because for years, labor unions were giving proceeds to the Labour Party, but the Labour Party has turned their backs on them and are much, much more are much more interested in receiving campaign donations from cosmopolitans in London who don't like the kind of mean rhetoric of Boris Johnson, but certainly don't want to see the person whose work gets them to their job on time, delivers their food or anything like that, sees any kind of increase in their standard of living. And I mean, there is a, in many ways, when the Bernie movement and the Corbyn movement were at their height, we were oftentimes trying to do, you know, cross the pond analysis, right? What can we learn from the Corbyn Labour Party, right? And I think this is a moment, not just this strike itself, but all of the things that have gone on, right? From the election of Sharon Graham at Unite the Union, which took a very, very hardline stance against Keir Starmer and the backstabbing members of the Labour Party, that they're not going to fund them anymore. They're not going to stand with them anymore if they're not going to fight for workers. And you know what? We're going to fight for ourselves, because we're realizing that all of y'all are just trying to sell us a raw deal here. Right. In the same way that we learned from some of, you know, Corbyn's rhetoric or movements or strategies, this is something that us in the United States can really see as an example of a way to not step out of politics because we're not sort of operating within one of these major parties, but to actually engage in politics on our terrain, which is the terrain of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have a couple more of these Mick ones that I think are worth getting to if we could.
Yeah, is this the James Connolly?
Yeah, bury the lead there. So this is Mick Lynch here noting who one of his most important one of his, who his favorite political figure of all time.
I like the hashtag in the background. It says hashtag McMania, and I'll just say, like, compared to speaking of the Liberal Democrats, hashtag Cleggmania, this is quite an improvement.
I think so.
Who's your political hero?
James Connolly.
James Connolly?
Do you know who James Connolly is?
He's an
Irish socialist Republican. And he educated himself and he started non-sectarian trade unionism in Ireland. And he was a hero of the Irish Revolution.
So he is your hero?
No, he's
what
a
about,
hero.
What about...
That's just like a fuck yes moment. Like, that's exactly who you want to be in the room fighting for working people, somebody who's learned from the incredible work of James Connolly. And if it's not too shameless, if people are interested in James Connolly, we did an incredible conversation with one of our good friends and teachers, Paul O'Connell. Do you have that?
Yeah, here we go.
That cover handy. Our radical tradition, James Connolly, which is now, it'd be great if you signed up at patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access, but it has also been released to the public, so you can find that on YouTube. I mean, James Connolly really is one of those people who not only was an incredible theorist and writer, was somebody who was an active participant and a revolutionary. And there's a lot you can learn from his movement there.
I mean, it is absolutely zero surprise that Mick would look up to this guy based on, you know, I mean, you'll see, like, it's almost like, are they time travelers? Like, do we have a bunch of time traveling union guys? Because the principles, they stay the same, it looks like.
Building off of that great Irish tradition there.
Yeah.
Well, man, I mean, I'm sure we'll, I mean, this is ongoing, so there's going to be more to cover. Is there anything else that you wanted to note here?
I just want to say, like, this is a good time, you know, for social media activism. Flood the zone with positive sentiment, because they're going to come for this guy. I'm afraid.
Oh, no doubt about it.
You look at the Tory press, what they did to Corbyn. Like, this is...
They came after Corbyn, who was, like, one of the most agreeable people in the history of politics. Yeah.
This is... So, like, get out there, join McMania, and, you know, have his back. And also, all the striking workers. I mean, that shouldn't need to be said, mm-hmm. I guess. But, you know, yeah.
So we'll keep covering this. We're really excited. So here's what we're going to do, y'all. In just a second, we're going to go over to Chip Gibbons, who joined us to talk about the Biden administration's attempt to bring him over to this country to torture him for exposing American war crimes of the most egregious nature. It's a very important conversation, and Chip is a really wonderful organizer, writer, journalist, and I hope that y'all enjoy it. We did title this Texas GOP Goes Off the Rails, but we're going to do – I'm going to do that tomorrow during the Griscom stream. I think I'll probably go on around 5 Central. So if you want to get that, you'll get that tomorrow, Thursday afternoon, 5 Central. I'll also be talking about Colombia, the French elections, because there's some really exciting stuff that came out of that as well. So don't worry, we're not ignoring those stories. We're just going to have to come back to them, because I think that this movement here in the UK is truly a very, very exciting one. I mean, one of the biggest strikes that we've been able to cover on this program, and one of the biggest strikes in the country in decades. So sorry, that's going to come to the top of the docket for us every time.
Absolutely. And I'm going to be doing a Lek Reckoning Friday evening, so look forward to that.
And one more plug. Immediately after our interview with Chip, we'll come on, say hello, say goodbye, and then we're going to go over to Twitch, twitch.tv/LeftReckoning, where we are going to be joined by Gene Bajelon, who's going to talk about the new project, Sublation Media and Sublation Magazine. We talk about the state of the left and a few other really fun things. And as always, after that, we'll be taking your questions and calls. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-940-289-7234. But yeah, we'll be doing that. And usually we say we're going to do it immediately. This time we really will. Like, once this is over, we'll be popping over at Twitch. So we'll see all of y'all there. But enjoy this conversation we have with Chip here.
Peace. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Lick. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Man, happy to be here.
And joining us once again, journalist Chip Gibbons. Chip is, you can read Chip in Jacobin, The Nation, In These Times. He's a policy director of Defending Rights and Dissent and the host of the Still Spying podcast. Chip, thanks so much for being here, even though it's, again, not under great circumstances for what our country's doing.
I'm happy you always have me back. I wish our government would make better choices, and then you would not have to invite me back. But, you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have time to interrogate those incentives if Chip is invested in our government continuing
if
to be.
Joe Biden wants me to go away. Stop the extradition of Julian Assange. A win-win for everyone.
Maybe David, you have some idea on this. Should we start with what we know, thanks to Julian Assange? Or should we start with the topical? Okay, yeah. So give us a breakdown of what we know, thanks to Julian Assange's disclosures.
I mean, we know a tremendous amount of things thanks to Julian Assange's disclosures. The disclosures that he's being prosecuted are a number of war logs from Iraq and Afghanistan, State Department cables, and the detainee assessment files from Guantanamo Bay. I have somewhere on my bookshelf behind me a book called The WikiLeaks Files, published by Verso, where every chapter are different experts from a particular region, Latin America, Southeast Asia, just going through the massive cache of files from those countries. So we know all kinds of things from, we know about, of course, that gunship that gunned down the two Reuters journalists in Iraq. We know how many civilian casualties they had recorded in Iraq. We also know things about U.S. support for corruption in Tunisia that allegedly or arguably inspired the Arab Spring. We know that the U.S. was bombing Yemen, and Yemen was taking credit for the bombings. We know that in Latin America, they were trying to undermine left. I mean, we obviously always know they're trying to undermine left-wing governments in Latin America, but we had the actual proof there. There's some very interesting cables from, I believe, the Israeli minister or from Israel about Iran, where they tell the U.S. they're too sensitive after the weapons of mass destruction and are not making good judgments about assessing Iran's nuclear threat because they don't want a repeat of that incident. We know that in Haiti, they put pressure on the Haitian government to not raise the minimum wage. So really, in every country, in every corner of the world, we know what the U.S. was doing in that corner, and it was not good. It's worth going back to how Chelsea Manning described her actions with the man who was unfortunately the snitch who turned her in. I'm not going to say his name, but you know, she mentioned that she wanted to remove the fog of asymmetrical warfare and let the American people have a debate on that. And also, with the State Department cables, she had all these cables from what I think she described as crazy, almost criminal backroom dealings that show how the first world exploits the first world. So what we know is how the U.S. empire operates, both in terms of the sorts of horrible military invasions and occupations and these murderous war crimes like what we saw in the collateral murder video, and both in terms of stuff like exerting diplomatic pressure in order to get one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere to not raise its minimum wage.
Yeah, I'm just going to say this up top, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, a little bit later. But one thing that's like really notable and worrying to me about this round of extradition we're getting from the U.S. is the kind of PR war against Assange, particularly with liberals in this country, right? Because, you know, the things that when, you know, he's exposing American war crimes abroad, I think a lot of liberals coming out of maybe some kind of anti-war position, you know, viewed him in a favorable light. But then the emails that were leaked from the Clinton campaign, a lot of people have sort of taken that as a justified excuse for the American state to now bring him over to this country and torture him for journalism. And I just want to say, like, up front, even if that was what they were doing, was coming after him for leaking the emails, I would be against it, right? Because this is a journalist who got information that was useful. I mean, that, you know, in those emails, it was exposed the amount of collusion against Bernie Sanders. This was somebody who's about to be the president of the United States, right? That is, like, deserves to be in public knowledge and public record straight up. But again, it's worth reminding folks that what the state is coming after Assange for right now is exposing American war crimes abroad.
Yeah, I mean, you could read the indictment, and I usually have it in front of me, and I'll read the counts, and I'll be like, count five, unauthorized disclosure of national defense information, parentheses, Guantanamo detainee assessment files. Mm-hmm. Count whatever, unauthorized disclosure of national defense information, Iraq war logs, right? The counts in the indictment spell out what the quote-unquote, because the Espionage Act, wonderful act, predates classification, very helpful, predates modern First Amendment jurisprudence, very, very helpful. So it uses this obtuse phrase called national defense information. And in each of the counts, they put in parentheses what it is, and it's Iraq war logs. It's Guantanamo Bay. Like, it says it in the indictment. Like, there's no question. And, you know, you'll see people in the comment sections of, like, the ACLU, like, why are you doing this? I thought you were on our side. Don't you know Assange is a Russian agent who leaked Hillary Clinton's emails? And that's what he's wanted for. And it's like, have you ever read the indictment? Like, that's not what he's wanted for. And it's worth pointing out that Mueller and the Mueller investigation considered the issue of charging Assange and declined to do so due to lack of evidence. And it's also worth pointing out the DNC sued WikiLeaks, and the suit was thrown out on First Amendment grounds, on the grounds that WikiLeaks, it's a well-established First Amendment principle that a journalist is not responsible for sharing wrongfully obtained information so long as they did not participate in wrongfully obtaining it. And I know there's a huge debate about where the DNC cables came from. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. But even if you assume the worst case scenario, right, there's no crime there. I mean, it was literally, it's much easier to bring a civil suit against someone than it is for a criminal one. And a judge threw out the DNC's claims against WikiLeaks on the basis of the First Amendment. Mueller did not indict Assange under anything to do with Russia. And while I share your agreement that there is no basis for prosecuting him for the DNC leaks, you know, this whole argument that Hillary Clinton would have won if only the American people had not known truthful information about her, like, that's a really bad argument. You know, I mean, it's such a weird, like, oh, well, I mean, did she do these things? Yes. Are these her views? Yes. But if the American people hadn't known it, I'm not a big Hillary Clinton fan, but I will point out, like, she got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. And due to this very antiquated system called the Electoral College, which was designed in part based on slavery, but also just sort of the broader issue of the states that had the most people had the lowest number of voters, right? Both because of slaves and because of, you know, property limitations on franchise, right? Mm-hmm. So the states with the biggest populations let the less people vote, and the states with the smallest populations let the most people vote. And this is literally what they say at the Constitution Convention. James Madison, father of the Constitution, says popular election or popular vote is best, but under popular vote, Virginia will never get to elect her leaders. Guess what state has the most presidents from it? Virginia.
Yeah.
So the Electoral College is a very good system for electing Virginians in the early 1800s, based on a slave society. Is it a good system for determining the president in a 2016? I would say no. I'm happy to hear another argument, but it's a very good system for electing Virginians. You know, when you consider its stated purpose is popular vote is best, but with popular vote, Virginia will never. It really did work out very well, as it was mm-hmm. supposed to do. They just don't teach that part. But no. And I'm also aware that, you know, he was accused of various serious crimes in Sweden, and that plays a huge role in some people's diminished view of him. Although two different United Nations bodies. Both the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention and the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, the Special Rapporteur on Torture who reads Swedish and read 10,000 pages of Swedish documents in the original language, have criticized what the Swedish government did. The investigation never resulted in any charges, and the claim that he sort of avoided accountability for this investigation by Heidi and embassy is false. When Sweden mm-hmm. drops the preliminary investigation the final time, Julian Assange is in UK custody. The UK and the Swedish courts say you cannot extradite him to Sweden because you can interview him for a third time. He's already submitted to two interviews from Swedish prosecutors this time. You can interview him for a third time in UK custody, and the Swedish government has him being detained by the UK. They have a chance to interview him a third time, and they say, we will not do so because no amount of evidence will ever produce a case we can take to court. Goodbye. And I understand that sexual assault is a very serious crime, and it's a crime that is oftentimes not taken seriously or under-investigated. And, you know, some of Assange's supporters have made comments that are unreflective of the sensitivity of the situation. Those people who brought these allegations have a right to be taken seriously and have a right to be. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this was not an under-investigated thing. I mean, you had a landmark Interpol red notice for someone who was wanted for questioning. And some of the actions of the Swedish government were criticized not just by various UN bodies, but by the UK group Women Against Rape on the grounds that by so clearly politicizing this, they were doing a disservice to, you know, the actual pursuit of justice. So I do understand that's a very sensitive allegation and we should take it seriously, but it never resulted in a charge. Assange initially delays his time in Sweden to submit to the first round of questions. I'm not going to go through all the legal history here. He agrees to an interview in the embassy and he agrees to go back to Sweden on the basis that they would agree not to extradite him to the U.S. And as the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Torture has said, that is a reasonable demand. It has some fancy international non-refoulement, the principle of non-refoulement. And, you know, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Torture has said point blank, when a government refuses to embrace the principle of non-refoulement, that's a huge red flag. Mm-hmm. And we know that the Australian government believed using this sort of bizarre legal method called temporary surrender, the Swedes could have very easily put him in U.S. custody. So I really, you know, it's a serious allegation. Maybe it wasn't taken seriously enough, but it has no bearing on what the U.S. wants him for. And that process, you know, it played out and it didn't result in anything. And I'm not sure what we're supposed to do with that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just important to go through those because I think that There is a kind of strategy, I think, from people, at least within the Democratic Party, who want to just, you know, see this person in prison, regardless of what the reasonings are.
Can I just jump in there, David? Yeah. Like, you know, even, you know, we went up top with the actual valuable disclosures that Assange has given us. Even if you took out everything of like sort of journalistic value and limited it to like the things that make people suspect he's just like an anti-Democrat agent, like the Hillary emails are. And I don't remember this as much, but I remember having a kind of issue with the ClimateGate emails. And thinking like, and maybe that was just like their like, we'll publish anything stance. I don't have the full, but even if you limited to that, you still have to understand like the precedent, which I think would be wrong to do. Like what is being like Chip says, what's in the indictment, what they're actually going after him for. It's for the stuff that, well, I guess we're going to factor out the equation. That's actually valuable to expose in the way our government and military operates.
I mean, and WikiLeaks also, I mean, the first big thing they had in the U.S. was Sarah Palin's emails in 2008. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear anybody bemoaning them for, you know, stealing John McCain's rightful, you know, if only the people had it known he appointed an idiot to be his vice president. I mean, I believe when he appoints Sarah Palin or nominates her, you know, she has the highest approval rating of any governor in the country, like real good pick. Mm-hmm. Turns out... not that sharp. Bit of a loose cannon. But no one ever bring like what about her emails? Like no one ever does that to Sarah Palin.
No, that's a good point. And
who is now a Julian Assange supporter in our very troubling political time. She has decided that she wants to read Hillary's emails so much she is willing to support the man who leaked her emails.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we should get to that in a moment, actually, just the way it has been sort of politicized in this country. But before we get there, I wanted to sort of talk about the extradition, where it's at. But I think before we get there, maybe just to set the stage a little bit, here's a clip from Apolitical.org, an interview done by Loki with Stella Morris, who is now married to Julian Assange, Stella Assange. And I think this just gives a good sense for people why this precedent is not only scary, but actually what Assange is very likely to be subjected to in the United States is so worrying.
But the prospect of the U.S. extradition is what the gravest fear is around, because in the United States, he would be placed in extreme isolation, solitary confinement in the U.S. prison system is routine. On any given day, it's estimated that 80,000 people are in solitary confinement in the United States. But because his case concerns the publication of classified material, it's considered a national security case, and so they have an excuse to say it's a national security case, so we have to place him in isolation. The fact that he's a suicide risk also gives them reason to isolate him. And that's why there's just no question that if he goes to the U.S., he will be extremely isolated, far, far worse than anything he's experiencing in Belmarsh.
And just to be clear too, what he's experienced in Belmarsh has been horrific too.
Yes. Yeah, it's really awful. And Belmarsh is one of the most notorious prisons in the UK. And I believe, I'm not an expert in the UK prison system, quickly becoming one, unfortunately. But I believe it is reserved for a lot of high-profile national, quote-unquote, national security defendants. Any of these so-called national security prisons are clearly designed to be punitive because the people there are presumed to be enemies of the state by virtue of their existence. And I want to comment on some of what Stella wrote or said. I mean, I wrote a piece for Jacobin, really... based on my own time as a correspondent, I attended virtually some of the hearings in the extradition, and I read through the court papers and stuff. The big issue. So what happened was, let me go back a little bit. So I think a lot of people thought that the U.S. would never extradite or indict Julian Assange under the Espionage Act, because espionage is considered a textbook political offense. Like, if you get a law textbook out and you look up political offenses doctrine, they'll say there's absolute political offenses and relative political offenses. Absolute political offenses are espionage, treason, and sedition, right? These are things that most extradition treaties bar the extradition of. They've made this bizarre legal argument in the UK. I cannot tell you I followed decades of UK extradition law, but that the current treaty with the US supersedes past things and does not prohibit political questions as a non-extraditable offense. But most people thought they would never go for espionage, because it is such a textbook example of something you cannot extra. And it makes sense, right? There are people in Langley, I hope this doesn't scandalize anyone, they're committing espionage against Russia, against China, probably against Germany and the UK too. Like, if Vladimir Putin puts forward a extradition request, send me the CIA for espionage, I mean, that's no country is going to honor that. And there's a reason why that is something you don't extradite people for. And that was completely thrown aside. The initial judge, the district judge, which is called in the UK court system a DJ, which I have oftentimes found sort of perplexing when I'm listening to these hearings and they keep talking about a DJ. And I'm like, what is this disc jockey doing? But no, the DJ rejected all of the press freedom arguments, but ruled that his treatment in the U.S. would be oppressive given his mental health. They specifically focused in on what's called special administrative measures, which they place on some national security defendants, including the alleged source for the Vault 7 leak, whose second trial is happening right now, Joshua Schulte. And he's been in these really horrible conditions, as well as the conditions at ADX Florence. The U.S. came back after the decisions and gave assurances that they would not put Assange in under SAM, Special Administrative Measures, or in ADX Florence, unless he did something after being in the U.S. that made them do it. So, you could drive a truck through. But even in these assurances where they're like, we're not going to torture him, they talk about where he's likely to be held, which is the William G. Truesdale Alexandria Adult Detention Center in Alexandria, Virginia. I'm familiar with this jail because I have sent letters or requests for help to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture on behalf of people who have been detained there. So I'm very actually familiar with the treatment of people there. It's not good. And Gordon Cromberg, who is this sort of supervillain type figure, who pops up in all of these terrible national security cases. He claims there's no solitary confinement there before he described the jail's protective housing custody and administrative segregation housing units. Inmates in this custody are not allowed to interact with other inmates, and they are kept in their cells 22 hours a day. But according to the British prosecutors and the DOJ, holding someone in their cell for 22 hours a day isn't solitary confinement because, and this is Gordon Cromberg speaking on behalf of our government, inmates in administrative segregation are able to speak to one another through the doors and windows of their cells. I'm quoting his court filing now, and that inmates can meet with their lawyers. And I just want to be clear that, like, the United Nations Nelson Mandela rules define solitary confinement. Okay, they define it as 22 hours or more a day without meaningful human contact. And solitary confinement in excess of 15 days constitutes prolonged solitary confinement, which violates international law and can amount to torture. So they are literally describing something that meets the international legal definition of cruel and degrading treatment. So even if, and so much of the appeals was focused on whether or not anyone can trust, what the U.S. government has assured. And the answer is no, you cannot. But like, even if they follow their assurances, they are assuring the U.K. they will torture him. Like, that is the text of what they say. And a lot of people just in the mainstream media were unwilling to pick up on this. But like I said, I've known people who have been held in this jail, and I have advocated on their behalf confidentially with the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. The conditions there are terrible. We know what Chelsea Manning went through there. We know what Jeffrey Sterling went through. We know what Paul Manafort, like whatever you think of Paul Manafort, we know how he was treated there. And it was torturous. I mean, we know if he goes there, they'll torture him. Like, that's not even an open question. They're point blank saying it.
It says a lot about the U.S. and the U.K. This is happening. And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it wasn't just because the judge felt like, oh, it's bad, and he felt for Assange. Like, wasn't there something statutorily on the books in the U.K. that you can't extradite to countries that might do stuff like that?
I believe so. I'm not an expert on U.K. law, but definitely if the extradition is oppressive, then you cannot extradite them. There was a bunch of arguments in the appeals about what tests should have been applied, whether or not a particular expert should have been disqualified. And then the higher court overturned the DJ and said that these conditions wouldn't have been oppressive. The Supreme Court refused to hear. The higher court then gave them permission to appeal to the Supreme Court based on some of the appeals issues they want to raise, not all of them. You have to get permission from one court to appeal to another. That I don't really understand the UK legal system. I'll be very blunt. And then the Supreme Court ruled they would not hear the case. And then Priti Patel, the UK Home Secretary, has signed the extradition hearing or extradition request. Now they have 14 days to ask permission to file what's called a cross appeal. And that is from those parts of the judge's decision that went against Assange. So the press freedom claims and the political questions question. So the judge rejected his press freedom claims, supported his prisons are bad in the U.S. claims. Higher court threw that out. Now the Home Secretary has signed the order. Now they can appeal the press freedom stuff. And then after all that is said and done, they can still go to the European Court of Human Rights, which is not part of the EU. It's part of the Council of Europe. The European Court of Human Rights is able to issue binding decisions. It's done a lot of past interesting binding decisions around LGBT rights in Ireland, around treatment of IRA prisoners in the UK. And it's worth pointing out as an aside, the Council of Europe, which the court is part of, Commissioner for Human Rights, asked Priti Patel publicly not to extradite Assange because of the human rights. Obviously, the court is independent from the commissioner, but it is an institution that has acted less like the U.S. and U.K. courts and more like the U.N., right? It seems to be actually willing to take the human rights issue seriously, and that's one possible avenue. And then if that doesn't work, then he's in the U.S. and we can discuss the legal strategies there when that happens. Hopefully it never happens. I'd love to talk to you about something else, but I'm hoping we're not all sitting here talking about Julian Assange being in the Alexandria Detention Center. I think that is a conversation I hope to never have in my life.
And you know, just one thing that I know when we had you on last, we talked about this, but it's just worth re-upping. The fact here is that Assange is not an American citizen. To my knowledge, has never like very much operated inside of the United States in the first place. And the precedent, like not like just on the, like on the first level, it's like, are we going to come after journalists? Like that's extremely scary. But it's also this really perverse privilege now that the United States is extending to the rest of the globe, which is that we will try you, you know, in this country with our horrific legal system if you so much as sort of step in our way, right? Which is a very, very worrying precedent. And one, not to get too, you know, starry-eyed, misty-eyed about this country, but, you know, ostensibly, this is a democracy. This stuff is happening in our name as American citizens, and it's something that we should be extremely uncomfortable with the government taking these huge steps to do.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of extraterritorially applying the Espionage Act is absurd for the reasons I outlined earlier. Even if you were dealing with, like, actual espionage, are you going to ask Putin or China or the CIA to extradite their spies? No, that's absurd. To extraterritorially claim the right to seize, capture, and bring to your country a foreign journalist, a foreign publisher of information, to stand trial for publishing truthful information about your war crimes. I mean, that is a shocking claim. And that's not just the death of the First Amendment. That is the death of press freedom globally. And I think one of the reasons why we see such a strong reaction to this around the world, where the reaction is very different than the U.S. reaction, is because to most people outside the U.S., this is a powerful empire using the full weight of its power and prestige and repressive apparatuses to torture and capture one of its critics, right? This is a guy who poked his stick in the eye of the U.S. by exposing truthfully our war crimes, and now we've plotted to kidnap him, we've plotted to kill him, we've done all these terrible things, and we've tortured him, and now we're going to put him on trial. And I think to the rest of the world, I mean, it looks really horrible, and that's why you see, you know, liberal or mainstream newspapers in the UK or Australia, like, really taking hardline editorial lines against this. I mean, imagine if, I don't know, Alexei Navalny was in, like, Belarus and they were going to or not. I don't know. I'm trying to think of. So imagine someone in this country who writes for, like, Foreign Policy Magazine or the Atlantic Council about, you know, corruption in Russia. Imagine if, like, Belarus, you know, seized him from the Canadian embassy and then we're going to extradite him to Russia. Like, think about the reaction to that would be. And that is how the rest of the world rightfully feels about this. And, you know, the fact that Assange revealed so much about U.S. abuses towards the global South, Latin America, Haiti, Middle East, I really think that also creates this dynamic where people in the global South really have a strong understanding of what this is about, you know?
Yeah. And, like, maybe just to follow up with that, we have this short clip. It's in Spanish, y'all, as it should be, of AMLO speaking about Julian Assange. This was just a couple days ago, courtesy of Kurt Hackbarth. I'm just going to play a couple seconds of the audio because in it, he mentions that he is going to pressure Biden on this issue. And in his press conference, actually played some of the footage of a U.S. Apache helicopter that ended up killing 18 people, including two journalists. So I'll just play this for a couple seconds.
We got a guy shoot. Now he's behind the building.
Sí, de unos pilotos, la conversación, están viendo un grupo y se están poniendo de acuerdo para disparar. Pero son periodistas los que fueron blanco.
And it's just it's worth noting that because I'm curious what your thoughts are on this, that, like, there has been, you know, significant condemnation. Obviously, we all know the reason that Assange was in the Ecuadorian embassy was at first that government was trying to give him some form of asylum. You saw Mélenchon, who ended up not winning outright the prime minister position, but saying that he would make Assange a French citizen and give him a Medal of Honor immediately. Unfortunately, that didn't come to pass. I mean, and also just noting, too, for people who've been watching the show, you know, we've been talking about how AMLO has been taking more of these kind of stances. He also called the American blockade of Cuba genocide. I'm just curious, you know, your feelings on the kind of international response regarding this case, specifically mainly from international governments, too.
I mean, you look around the world at who the big people of the international left are: Jeremy Corbyn, Yanis Varoufakis, the former socialist prime minister, I think they're prime minister of Spain, Zapatero, Lula, you know, Correa. They've all supported Julian Assange. The left around the world in parliament has supported them. And in many of these cases, they cite things that Julian Assange revealed that were positive to their country. I don't think Mélenchon brought it up in that quote, but in the past, when he's talked about inducting Julian Assange into the Legion of Honor, he mentions that Julian Assange exposed NSA surveillance of French presidential candidates, right? Mm-hmm. And they haven't, you know, Yanis Varoufakis has spoken about information, I think, with the IMF or one of these international sort of monetary monsters, you know, and Greece in Latin America. He has exposed lots of information about U.S. interference in Latin America. And, you know, even if you're not in a country where there's information about sort of interference, I mean, watching that video of that attack helicopter, and I always get very, I mean, I've seen it a bunch of times, and I always get very emotional when I watched it because, you know, there's a scene in it where tries to save children, and that is Ethan McCord, and hasn't been in the public life for a long time, but he did interviews with Democracy Now! and other stories, and, you know, I watched that video once in a room with him, okay? Like, I watched the collateral murder video in a room with one of the people who were in it, and that has never left me, okay? That, to this day, really, really haunts me. I mean, it's such a horrible crime, and to know what some of the people on the ground who tried to do something about it and were ignored and were just totally chewed up by the VA mental health system. It's really an ugly story at every turn. And you know, after that, I'm never going to leave this case alone, having had that experience. That's a huge driving factor for me. And you know, people look at that and they're disgusted by it. And I think for a lot of the world, especially in countries where they know what it's like to have a big country or a big multinationals have their boot on your neck, take away your dignity, take away your sovereignty, override your system, they totally look at Julian Assange as a hero who exposed an empire and is paying the ultimate price because that empire wants to silence and punish anybody who stands up to them. And you know, that's how he's viewed in a lot of parts of the world. I mean, I know in the U.S., he was mean to the CIA, and he was mean to Hillary Clinton, and some of his tweets had some bad stuff in it, right? But you know, once you get outside of that, you know, this is a man who took on empire because he believed that if lies can start war, truth can end them. Okay? That was his operating motto. That is what he set out to do, and he has been tortured. Okay? The United Nations have found he has been tortured. And I've interviewed the UN Special Rapporteur who made that finding. He brought medical experts with him, and they examined him. It was an extremely rigorous process, and he's totally open about the fact that he went into it not wanting to be involved because he thought Julian Assange was a bad man and because he thought the charges of torture were farcical. But he brought independent medical experts, independent psychiatrists, people who are experts in torture, and they examined him, and they discovered he had been psychologically tortured. And the more he learned about the case, the more he learned everything he'd been told was a lie. And then, you know, he's very famously said, you cannot expect the people who Julian Assange exposed to tell us the truth about him. So I think it's great that AMLO is standing up for Julian Assange. I know in the past he's offered him asylum. I know Ecuador offered him asylum. And I really do think that there is a story with the Assange revelations that are about sort of left-wing Latin American governments reasserting their sovereignty against the U.S. With the Ecuador thing, you know, you always hear this story that he wore out his welcome with the Ecuadorians. He was too messy in the embassy, so they evicted him, which is a bullshit media narrative. I mean, you had a government in Ecuador that supported him. Correa, Guillaume Long, God, I'm blanking on the other guy, the consular in London. They all still support him. They still all publicly support him. But another government came in and got all these loans from the IMF, and Mike Pence went down to Ecuador and members of the Democratic Party sent Mike Pence a letter saying, in Ecuador, you better bring up the Assange issue. The UK had an entire program called Operation Pelican to get him out of the embassy. So it's not that Julian Assange wore out his welcome. It's that one government asserted their sovereignty in protecting him, and another completely capitulated to the United States, as many, many governments around the world do. But you'll never hear a story about the independence and sovereignty of Latin America in the U.S. press, you know.
Guess the I don't know if you might remember, Chip, for David. Guess the senator that led the Democrats sending that letter to, you know, bring up
Bob
Assange.
Mendes.
Yep, Bob Mendes. So, like, maybe the most corrupt guys in Congress. But yeah,
I just. This is what we're stuck with. I mean, in the rest of the world, you know, it's like Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott and Yanis Varoufakis and Belen Shaw be like, what are you doing, U.S.? And we get, like, Democratic Party, Bob Mendes, Mike Pence is soft on Julian Assange, soft on journalism, Donald Trump. You know, yeah, Donald Trump notoriously soft on journalism.
And, I mean, I don't know if you noticed anybody else, but I think is it true that Ilhan Omar is the only Democrat that's spoken out in favor of Assange, or has anybody joined her?
So that's very complex. Kahana has repeatedly spoken out in favor of Assange. Kahana did a live stream a little while ago. Ilhan Omar reshared Mehdi Hassan's segment about it with, like, a positive emoji. AOC has been heavily criticized by Assange supporters correctly. However, she has on two occasions stated that Obama was correct to not bring charges, but she did this interview with Jeremy Scahill where he asked her if she poured it pardoning him, and she kept saying, it's very complicated, it's very complicated, it's very complicated. And eventually he pinned her into answering, and her answer was he should not be charged under the Espionage Act, but she was definitely not willing to answer that question, did not show tremendous courage. Elizabeth Warren had a very interesting remark, which was that Julian Assange is a very bad man who's harmed U.S. national security, but Donald Trump should not use him to undermine the First Amendment. I think Sanders did another very Trump-focused tweet. All of the Democratic presidential candidates were asked by the New York Times in a questionnaire about Assange, and some of them actually gave some interesting answers. But the most outspoken members of Congress on this issue are, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene and I think Babard or whatever her name. I stopped following the super friend. Bobert. Yeah, well, and it's not good.
Well, it's certainly not good, and it's like it's worrying because if you are noting when these things are happening, right? So when there's a little bit of a courage of talking about, as you noted, a lot of it was very Trump focused, right? And it's just like, okay, so whoever's doing it, the other people are going to get worked up about it, right? So, like, if Biden's the one behind it, then Marjorie Taylor Greene is upset by it. Certainly she wouldn't be and wasn't when Trump was pursuing it. And yeah, you get worried with the backbone of a lot of people who we might consider progressives in the Democratic Party not being able to stand up against it when effectively you have the most power to influence when it's your own guy doing it.
I think some of the Trumpers were critical when Trump was doing it because they had it's the deep state doing it. Donald, I believe Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar were outspoken then, as not to give them credit.
No, I mean, it's worth noting.
And I really think there are a lot of members of the Democratic caucus who are completely uninformed on this issue. And, like, you talk to them and it's like, what's Julian Assange been indicted for? It's Russia, right? It's like, no. And then you have others like AOC who I think know what the right thing to do is, but don't have the courage to do it. And I know for a fact that there's a sense on the Hill from people who have spoken out on this that there's a lot of risk for doing so and there's not any reward. And criticize any politician all you want. They all do terrible things and you should be vocal in criticizing them. But I do think we need to get better about creating a situation where these members of Congress are hearing from us, letting them know that we want them to speak out for Assange and we want them to amend the Espionage Act. And when they do so, to actually support them and have their backs. Because, you know, if you come out for Assange as a Democrat, you're going to have a lot of sort of backlash against you. And I really think there's no excuse for their cowardice, but I also think that we people who we could be doing better to push them along. Like there's a lot of, opportunities. There's opportunities here.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, the you mentioned about like the unthinking sort of like ignorance of a lot of like Dem staffers. It's like, how old are you? I'm only 33. How do I feel like Father Time with like a memory, like able to go back and put these things into like proper proportion? And that's their job. And like, I mean, the AOC thing is more understandable, just cowardice, right? And she's like, doesn't want to lead on a certain number of these issues and just needs to be pushed to. But the folks who are just like, oh yeah, that's the anti-Hillary guy, right? And but, it's horrifying.
There are leftists in AOC's district. If they made this a priority and they like went to her office and asked to talk to her about this, and they went to her town halls and are like, you know, I don't agree with this complicated comment, but you did say the charges should have been brought. Will you write a letter to Merrick Garland? Will you do this? Mm-hmm. Will you do that? Thank you for saying that the Espionage Act shouldn't be used against reality winner and Chelsea Manning. Will you sponsor legislation to amend it? You know, and if anybody wants to do this in AOC's district, please reach out to me. I can give you some talking points. But, you know, as someone who has spent a lot of time on the Hill trying to get progressive Democrats to speak out about Assange, someone who's been doing this since 2019, it is both very demoralizing but also kind of hopeful because there are these opportunities. And I think sometimes we focus too much on getting demoralized and not enough on, like, I mean, I once again, criticize AOC all you want. I have no interest in defending any of these people, but like the amount of energy that has been spent on her saying it's complicated versus her saying the charges shouldn't have been brought. Like, I don't know if that's where our focus should be. I mean, like, yes, it's not complicated, AOC, but you know the charges shouldn't have been brought. What are you doing to defend the First Amendment? I am your constituent, and I want you to speak for me on this issue.
Yeah, maybe a little bit too much lamenting the shut door and not enough looking for the open window, perhaps. Go ahead, David.
No, I think you're right, and I think it's worth talking about if you're open to it. That, like, you know, with the like the Free Assange movement in this country, I mean, it's hard to talk about as like one block because there's a lot of different sections in it. But I do get the sense that there is a section of it that is like just about having something that can be clinged on to. That like the system's not going to stand up for you, or like the people who you might look up to are going to fail you, right? And like that's a focus. And again, it's not incorrect, but it doesn't really create any kind of path out, because if like the criticism is just like the system's corrupt, then we're just watching, you know, this person march to being tortured without any kind of viable plan for doing something about that. And I've never found that to be particularly helpful. I think that that's a good point.
What I always say to people is that there's no guarantee if we do everything in our power and fight as hard as we can that we will save Julian's life. But if we do nothing, if we sit back and do nothing, he will die. And we will lose the right to expose war crimes with that. All we can do right now is fight as hard as we can and make the best effort possible to save him. Because when we fight, we don't always win. But when we don't fight, we always lose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an uphill battle, but the fact that I do see these openings after, I don't know how many fucking years I've been doing this, you know, walking around Capitol Hill with people who don't give a fuck, like, because I see a bunch of openings, I mean, I'm still sort of hopeful on this issue. I think if we just got our act together, we could save Julian. I don't think it's impossible. I think it's difficult, okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't criticize people who feel very disillusioned, because a lot of days I feel very disillusioned. I keep myself going by focusing on these extraordinarily small, extraordinary long shot openings, but by putting my energy into those, And you know, and there are days where, you know, I set up a bunch of meetings and they all get canceled mysteriously in a clearly coordinated way, and I'm like, I just like, oh. you know, all right, I do feel this way, and I don't want to criticize the people online who feel betrayed or disillusioned. I think, you know, there's a lot of criticisms of like alter tendencies or nihilism or whatnot, and some of them are bad. I think people fail to comprehend how many of them come from like disillusionment, right? Like mm-hmm. how many people really were expecting a lot from more than was possible, right? And when such a little amount was even delivered, it's really hard to have faith. I mean, I've become the person I've never wanted to be. I'm in a lot of these backroom meetings, and I watch like minuscule progress get. I'm like, oh, have hope. I assure you, behind closed doors, there are people who will do the right thing if you just put some pressure on them. Someone who's not me, preferably one mm-hmm. of their constituents. And I realize a lot of people, you know, if I was watching myself, I wouldn't believe any of that, right? I've heard people make those kinds of remarks. I'm like, that's bullshit. Stop defending these cowardly politicians. But I think we have to try to engage them. I think there are people who don't know anything who can maybe be reached. And I think there are people who know what the right thing is and need either be pushed into doing it or be made aware that there are people behind them who will stand with them. You know, I had an office talk to me about a particular domestic terrorism bill, and they were one of the only offices who was holding out on it, and they were like, I don't know what to do or not. And I said, you know, if you hold out on it, I'll stand with you, right? You have to be willing to say that to people. I mean, obviously, they're elected to serve us. They're elected to do their jobs. They should show courage no matter what, but like, sometimes they need to hear that there are people who will stand with them if they do the right thing. Because doing the right thing in Washington is an extremely lonely experience. I tell you what, after going on the BBC to defend, you know, Julian Assange, the most hated man in Washington, probably more hated than Osama bin Laden, I don't get many dinner party invites, okay?
No, I can imagine.
I'm not getting invited to Madeleine Albright's salon. which I would go if you're listening. Oh no, she's dead. Never mind. If anyone is listening who has a salon, I have no social calendar. I have rendered myself toxic in this city. Please invite me to your salons, your Ouija boards, whatever. You know, I have nothing but openings.
Yeah. You can fill out your party.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, because I you know,
come to wherever you are and visit you. You look like you're having fun.
Yeah. I'll just say I went to school in DC and lived there for a couple of years after graduating. And I think you're 100% right about Assange maybe being hated more than bin Laden.
Absolutely.
Just like the conversations you'd hear at bars were just truly remarkable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he did the two worst things you can do in D.C. He was mean to the CIA and he was mean to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
You know, the two people you don't cross in Washington, the CIA and Hillary Clinton. If you want to be disappeared, you know, do those two things.
Well, Chip, just
you know, pick one or the other. Pick Hillary Clinton or the CIA. If you do both, you're in trouble.
You're done. Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Chip, if there's anything that you'd like to sort of direct the audience to who might be inspired to maybe getting a little bit more involved, or maybe some events that maybe not like timeline things that they might be keeping their eye out on, you know, just how could we direct people who are feeling like, all right, it's time to stop despairing and pop private?
Please come to rightsanddissent.org and look at the Take Action section. We have so many actions around Julian Assange, around Daniel Hale, around the Espionage Act. I really think it helps for them to hear from you. If you want to, I can't believe I'm going to do this. If you want to like actually do more than just an online action, please feel free to reach out to me at chip@rightsanddissent.org. I'm going to regret giving my email out. I already do. And I am happy to help you set that up. Like, I am frustrated enough that if you want to go meet with your intransient congressperson, I will help you do it. Because I've already met with your intransient congressperson. So, you know, maybe maybe you can do a better job.
Well, very nice. Folks should follow Chip at ChipGibbons89 and at Rights Descent. Chip, thanks so much. And, you know, until
thank
next
you,
time.
Baby.
Yeah, we'd love it.
When Julian's free. We're going to do the Julian Freedom Show next time.
Chip is wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Really important work. Yeah, great talking to him. I just have one note. Laura Martin in the chat said we'd be interested to note that 25 Labour MPs did join the strike, including the leader of the Scottish Labour Party. So that's good, at least.
Well, hell yeah. Well, here's what we're going to do, because we went over a little bit on time, y'all. Tomorrow at 5 Central, I'm going to be doing a Griscom stream, and I'm going to talk about the Texas GOP. And they're truly frightening and out of control convention. Also have a Uvalde update. And yeah, we'll also talk about France and Colombia, because some exciting stuff happening there. But without further ado, remember, you can always sign up to support the show at patreon.com/leftreckoning. All this month, we are opening up the post game to the public on twitch.tv/leftreckoning. But usually that's going to be for members only. If you want to come over with us immediately after this, like usually we take a little bit of time. I think it's going to be like 2 minutes, 5 minutes tops. We're going to be joined by Gene Bajelon, talk about sublation media, the state of the left, a little bit on Bernie 24 again. But you can support the show at patreon.com/leftreckoning. You get the post game, and you also get a bonus episode each Sunday, and we'll have one for y'all coming out this Sunday as well. But I hope everybody enjoyed that conversation with Chip. Please do look into the action that website so that you can find ways to get involved, because this is a very dire moment, and it's right in front of us. The reality that Assange might be taken to the United States to face unspeakable horrors. And it's an important fight to be a part of. So try to find ways to get involved if you can.
And these issues are ones that you can are worth like trying to interface with your representatives on. There's a book, totally. Who Killed Berta Cáceres, on by Nina Lacani, about dams, death squads, and indigenous defenders for the battle. But like, I remember this book talks about how, like, even despite like the Clintons' role in Honduras, they had certain success reaching out to representatives on pushing the ball forward on certain issues, and it can work. And like Chip said, like a lot of these folks, they need to be pushed into doing
totally. They need to have a threat to yeah. their inaction.
Yep.
So again, you can leave us a message. We'll play in the post game at 1-940-289-7234. I'll say that again, 940-289-7234. And yeah, I'll be over there in like 5 minutes.
Peace.
Take care, everybody.